From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Those violent tornadoes overnight in Missouri have killed at least three people in Golden City in the southwest part of the state. They also caused widespread damage. And police are going door to door to check on people in the hard-hit state capital, Jefferson City. Governor Mike Parson was there earlier today, spoke with reporters.
We were very fortunate here in Jeff City last night to come through this, especially for injuries or fatalities here. But the damage is just devastating up here, you know, and we're days to come to get all this fixed. So there's a lot more work to be done the next day or two for all our emergency personnel.
This has been part of a week-long wild weather pattern. So let's bring in Frank Morris with KCUR in Kansas City. Frank, busy week.
Yes, it has. It's been a wild weather week here in the whole Midwest and the lower Midwest, Texas, down to Louisiana. Pretty wide area, but there have been a lot of storms.
Yeah, the tornadoes overnight are just some of the 200 that have passed through the region over the past 6 days. We know that this is an area familiar with tornadoes, but how unusual is this?
You know, it's unusual lately. There have been a few years where we haven't had very active tornado seasons. This amount and the 200 number is preliminary. You know, those are reported tornadoes. When the Weather Service gets around to verifying them, that number will go down. There's some redundancy there, but well over 100 tornadoes. It's unusual. And the thing is, it's not going to let up. This weather system is parked where it is. There's a weather map that shows a corridor of likely tornado weather across Missouri today. It's exactly the same place it was yesterday. So the conditions haven't changed a bit overnight. You would think all this turbulence, all this energy being expended in the atmosphere would break things up, but it hasn't.
Well, and this is also the eighth anniversary of a twister in Joplin that killed 158 people. We remember that.
Yeah.
You were reporting that day.
Absolutely.
I'm sure everyone who lived through that day is thankful that as bad as this is, it's not that bad.
Well, you know, and there's some PTSD with people who go through something like that.
Yeah.
Something that really turns everything upside down and destroys your house, destroys your town. So people who didn't move away, they have a visceral reaction to those tornado sirens going off, a lot of them. A lot of them have spent a lot of time trying to get back to normal in the last 8 years since that tornado.
Well, that must be terrible, again, to hear those tornado sirens. They are tough anyway. But it's not just tornadoes. You've got this rain and hail, flooding. Mm-hmm. Talk about how that's affecting, you know, the Missouri River.
Oh, well, so the Missouri River has been running high since March. It started very early this year with this bomb cyclone that swept through Nebraska, and it hasn't gone down. It hasn't gone down much below flood stage in some places, and it's right back up now. So the Missouri River is flooding in Jefferson City. So Missouri, one side of the river in Jefferson City, you've got the river overtopping the levees and that a mandatory evacuation order. The other side gets hit by a tornado. So that's the kind of weather we're having. But the flooding is very widespread. Oklahoma is a complete mess with rivers, creeks, flooding, you know, major flooding. All along the Missouri River, you've got this situation where the river's so high that the streams can't empty into it. You know, maybe the floodgates are closed or it's just too full. And so every time there's a rain, it floods. And we've had a lot of rain. We may be on track to have the wettest spring in recorded history. Mm. So the whole midsection of the country is flooding. Mm. And the flooding is actually more dangerous. You're more likely to die in a flood than you are in a tornado. Tornado is more dramatic. Flooding is more likely to kill people. And the flooding is going to go on. There's no end to this flooding in sight. I mean, because it's cumulative. And the weather is parked here. It's going to be the same weather system is going to be parked over the area for the next several days. And the flooding is just going to get worse and worse. And we're early in flood season in this part of the country.
So I'm sure people are being warned. You might want to rethink those Memorial Day driving plans and travel plans.
Well, there definitely are, you know, a number of closed roads, particularly in Oklahoma and around Jefferson City, and a number of other places. You know, I don't know how it affects plans, but it's, you know, they always try to hammer this in. You should not drive across
right.
running water, you know, turn around, don't drown, because not only is the water maybe rising, the road may be washed out from underneath of it. People die all the time in those kind of situations.
That's Frank Morris with KCUR in Kansas City, having a rough weather week. Frank, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his party are celebrating today after winning a landslide victory. Today's news sent India's stock market soaring, and it follows 6 weeks of voting in the world's largest democracy. Joining us now is the BBC's Divya Arya. She's in Delhi. Divya, Narendra Modi was not on the ballot, but this election was a referendum on his leadership so far, and it seems like a pretty big vote of confidence in him.
Indeed, we haven't seen a party come back to power in India with this kind of mandate. He has overdone himself from the last time. The numbers have gone up. We're still waiting for the final results, but the tally that's coming up is pretty clear, and the whole election was fought in his name, not even in his party's name. Every candidate in every constituency spoke in their rallies about Mr. Modi. So it was very clear to the voter that your vote is not for the Member of Parliament representing your constituency, but for Narendra Modi, mm-hmm. and it is to represent the whole country.
So help us understand how voters did what they did here, because since Modi has been Prime Minister, there's been a farm crisis, there's been problems with unemployment and growing religious divides.
Well, Mr. Modi has run an extremely successful communication campaign, and he has explained to the people that he is the kind of leader they need because he can take decisions when they are needed. The strikes that were made into Pakistan right after a terror attack onto security forces, 41 security forces were killed in the state of Kashmir just before the elections, was shown as an example of what how a country should respond, especially to Pakistan, with a country with whom we've had tensions for a really, really long time, and we've fought a couple of wars as well. His whole, his party's whole attitude towards the Hindu majority was another strong signal that went out to the public that the Hindu majority is better off in the governance of Mr. Modi and his party, not the secular Congress party, which ruled the country for many decades. And even today, when I went out to speak to people to find out how they were reacting to the government's re-election, this is exactly what they were looking forward to. They said, now the Hindus will feel that they're not being discriminated.
And what about the Muslim minority?
Well, the Muslim minority has seen a lot of, there's been a lot of fear that the Muslim minority has experienced. We've seen it amongst peers, amongst educated upper class people we interact with. We've also seen it in poorer areas where mob lynchings have happened. People have been lynched for carrying, transporting cows because cows are considered sacred in Hindu religion. And even people who were carrying cows for slaughter, which is legally permitted, were targeted. So there has been a sense of fear, and a lot of people on Twitter today, for example, have been talking about how going forward the minorities will have to be subservient in a way to the majority to live in harmony. But of course, the BJP party denies all of that, and they say that if you look at our policies, when we implement them, we do not discriminate on the basis of religion, and that is what matters at the end of the day.
Where do these results leave Rahul Gandhi's party, the Indian National Congress?
Well, it's a huge defeat for him. He just came and addressed the press a little while back, and he said he humbly accepts it because that is the people's verdict. And he was asked about his leadership, and he said that's something that the party will decide. So lots of questions for Mr. Gandhi to answer and also to reinvent, because the Congress, if this is not a wake-up call for it to sort of re-strategize its messaging, its party workers and what it stands for, we don't know when it will be.
One more thing, Divya. What is the relationship between India and the United States like, and what is it likely to be like with Narendra Modi staying in power?
Well, the relationship has been pretty good, and Mr. Modi has been credited with the, refurbishing all his relationships across the world. He's seen to be someone who's been very successful with his foreign policy. He's made visits to the United States. There's a strong community, Indian community there,
right,
that supports him. And of course, between him and President Trump, of course, there seems to be more points of agreement than disagreement. Both of them have a very nation-first kind of agenda, not to say that the Congress party here did not, but Mr. Modi has also spoken about, you know, stopping immigration into the country. They're talking about bringing a citizenship bill, which weeds out people who are not citizens and illegally they've come into the country. So there are lots of common grounds. And of course, there Pakistan being a common enemy, China, of course, being a common trade challenge to deal with. I think going forward, this is going to be probably good for both leaders. Whether it's going to be good for both countries, of course, is a question that I can't answer at the moment.
That's the BBC's Divya Arya joining us from Delhi. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And in that election in India, over the course of many weeks, 600 million voters at least. We'll keep watching what happens there. And also, we're keeping an eye on the UK, where people are voting today in the European Parliament elections, which they weren't even expected to vote for because they would have Brexited by now. That, of course, has not happened. Spanish-born chef Jose Andres is known for cooking. He's won James Beard Awards and been Michelin-starred, and for his restaurant empire with more than 30 restaurants, and for his good works. His nonprofit World Central Kitchen fed people in Haiti after the earthquake, Houston after Hurricane Harvey, and Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. Well, now, for the first time in 10 years, Jose Andres has a new cookbook. Vegetables Unleashed is the name of it, and Jose Andres joins us now. Welcome. And let me ask you first why you wanted to focus on vegetables at this point in your career.
Well, I think the conversation on bringing more vegetables and fruits to the diets of everybody has been around for quite some time. But then it seems we never do enough. You go to the restaurants and usually vegetables are a forgotten side dish. In my house, my wife, my children, we cook vegetables every single day of the week. We may have a little farm. And I see that vegetables, they deserve more respect than the respect we're giving them. If we want to be feeding the world, I do believe that vegetables are going to have to be at the center of the plate. So this is a way to say, hey, vegetables are here. We need to take them seriously, but don't be afraid of them. Vegetables are fun. They are mayhem. They like to misbehave. That's what we want to tell people about vegetables. Vegetables should be part of your life every single day.
Well, you say in the introduction to this book that fruits and vegetables are sexy in a way that a chicken breast can never be.
Well, imagine you put a chicken breast in your mouth and you start slowly munching. Yes, at the beginning you have some juices, if it's not well overcooked, flowing around your mouth. But after 4 or 5 seconds, those juices are gone. And then you are in your mouth with that kind of thing that is tasteless that you have to keep munching for 5, 10, 15 more seconds. And what the heck, I'm eating this? Why I'm putting this in my belly? A pineapple. In the moment you put it, before you bring it into your mouth, the smell, the freshness, you start munching. The pineapple, all the juices are flowing through your mouth from the beginning to the end. It's pure pleasure. Vegetables and fruits are much more interesting than a piece of meat.
Do you remember the first time that you had that thought about vegetables or about fruit?
Actually, I can tell you the first time I hated a vegetable was green peppers, and my mother will fry them, and she will give them for me for dinner, and I didn't want to eat them. And she sent them to my school for lunch, and then, because I didn't eat them, brought them back for dinner. I didn't eat them again, so she sent them back to the school. 2 days later, I ate the entire tray of green peppers, and now I can tell you that one of my favorite things in the world is the fried green peppers, as my mother used to make.
When was the first time, though, that you loved a vegetable, that you truly understood how wonderful it was?
I do believe that probably first time will be walking in this little town outside Barcelona, and where we will be having the cherries in season, and the cherries hanging from the tree. We will go up in the tree and we will eat the cherries without removing the pit and the stem from the tree. That was an unbelievable moment.
Now, in this book, you talk about a lot of things when it comes to vegetables that many people who are just amateur cooks may not even think about, like boiling the water and how you boil water when it comes to boiling vegetables. Tell me a little bit about that. Why is that so important?
Well, I think sometimes we are so complicated in the way we are trying to tell people how to cook. We need to make it simple for people. Nothing to me is more simpler than putting water and boiling the water and then adding any vegetable you want to cook. You can cook it to perfection. If you like it crunchy, you cook it less. If you like it more cooked, you leave it longer. You take it out of the water, some olive oil, maybe some Spanish paprika, pimenton, maybe some spices and sesame seeds, something very simple. You see, in 1 second, you can be feeding a big family in no time. To me, water sometimes is the most efficient technique to take care of vegetables.
I want to ask you about some of the recipes in your book. For example, the idea of compost potatoes. It could take some people by surprise. You say it may be the most insane recipe you've come up with.
Well, listen, in my house, yes, I have a little garden outside, and we do composting of all the food. And so the composting is something that's been going on in my house for many years. So we have a little thing in the kitchen that, you know, the onions and the leeks and whatever leftovers of cleaning vegetables, we keep them there. And then we put also the coffee grounds. And all of a sudden, my wife was about to take all of those vegetables and coffee of a couple of days to the compost bin. And I thought, hold on a second. This is the same compost that at the end is going to end in the dirt in the farm where we grow our potatoes. Why, if we cook the potatoes with the same compost, eventually they will become one? So we got all those leftovers, and I think in that moment we had from corn to coffee to tomato peels to potato peels. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of covered the potatoes on them, and we put them in the oven for almost an hour. And guess what? The potatoes cook, and those potatoes, between you and me, they were delicious. So this was only sending the message, why we don't cook the potatoes with the same compost is actually helping those potatoes to come to life.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You also have in here a beefsteak tomato sandwich, which you say when tomatoes are in season, you would take this sandwich over a BLT any day.
Well, I grew up in Spain with just plain white bread and mayo and some mustard, some tomatoes sliced that my father would make, and I love that. And when I came to America, I saw that also was kind of the same thing, that you will find this tomato sometimes in some of the dishes. And for me, making this tomato beefsteak sandwich, we began doing it because we opened a fast food restaurant called Beefsteak, where my idea was, let's do a fast food, which is called Beefsteak, but where 99% of the foods are vegetables. Mm-hmm. And we needed to have a sandwich, not only bowls of vegetables and grains. And so we made this, obviously, this beefsteak sandwich where, as you see, it's very juicy. When you go into your mouth with that bread and that mayo and the greens and the tomato and all the juices began flowing through your mouth, it's like, yes, a beef burger is awesome. But we need to be fair and give an opportunity to a humble tomato also to have a space on the table. And I love now to see that the beefsteak sandwich, every season when we put it on the menu, becomes one of the most successful items mm-hmm. on this fast food chain Beefsteak I opened a few years ago.
Jose Andres, people hear you here talking about food. You also own a number of restaurants, but you've also been in the news a lot recently. You opened up your restaurants to feed government workers who were furloughed during the shutdown. You've been heavily involved in relief work. You even helped introduce the Best Picture nominee, Roma, at the Oscars this year. Do you feel that you get enough time these days with all of your activities to focus on food?
Well, that's a fair question. At the end, I live and I breathe food every day on a kitchen or every day on a farmer's market or in my restaurants. At the end, cooking is not about I, the person. Cooking is about we, the people. Even in this book, you know, I try to celebrate the vast majority of the people that make this book possible. And I believe in we, the people. So me, I'm surrounded by an amazing team of individuals that makes everything possible and allows me to keep also doing the other things I like in life. If people are in need of a plate of food in Colombia, I am not the one doing it. My organization is. Do I go? Yeah. Do I spend there a few days, a week here, a week there? Yeah. But again, it's not I the person, but we the people. We have amazing people here in America and around the world that when something happens, they put everything aside only with one very simple mission, to feed those people that are hungry after an emergency. And I'm very, very lucky that I am part of that group of individuals that make it happen.
Have you ever considered running for political office?
Lately, I get this question more often than not. I think every single individual, especially the young, and I'm not so young anymore, they should consider about political life. Why? Because if we want to be part of change, we need to understand what that change may be like. And if we don't want to run for office, at least we need to understand what we should be asking our presidential candidates to change, to make America better, one plate of food at a time. Every single person should think, what if I run for office, and come up with a plan so they can know what to ask to their candidates. Well, for president, well, for the Senate, well, for the Congress, maybe local. But we all need to be a little bit more involved if we want to make America better every single day.
So that sounds like a yes, you have considered running for office.
Listen, if one day is an opportunity, who knows? Right now, I know I have this amazing restaurant group that I am the leader, that I enjoy doing. I also have World Central Kitchen, where we feed the people in need around the world. Those two things, I'm fairly busy. What I know is that if there is an opportunity to knock on Congress and tell our senators and congressmen that they need to improve the Farm Bill, that they need to make sure immigration reform is something that helps America move forward. Those are the kind of things that chefs like me, Tom Colicchio and others, you see as more and more showing up on the walkways of Congress to tell our senators and congressmen, we are watching and we are expecting from you to do better through food for the American people.
That is Jose Andres, whose new cookbook is called Vegetables Unleashed. Jose Andres, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now and the following message is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and anytime in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box at dailyharvest.com/now.
The Toronto Raptors and Milwaukee Bucks play Game 5 of their NBA Eastern Conference Finals Series in Milwaukee tonight. The best-of-seven-game series is tied at 2 wins apiece. The Golden State Warriors, oh, they're having their nails done, waiting for the winner of the series after sweeping the Portland Trail Blazers in 4 games to win the Western Conference Finals Monday night. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, I really don't think the Golden State Warriors are having their nails done.
They might be. Actual good pedicures and manicures, good maintenance as far as that goes.
It actually
affects performance.
We'll talk about them in a second. But what are you seeing so far in the Bucks-Raptors series?
Yes, this is not a Manny Petty type series. This is more a slug it out series. They each have a great player, both of these teams do. Kawhi Leonard on Toronto is a do everything offensive, defensive stalwart, but the big man in the middle for Milwaukee, Giannis Antetokounmpo, he should be the MVP. Maybe James Harden will be it. So that means they have different styles of offense. In Milwaukee's case, he creates everything Giannis does. I'll just call him by his last name too, Antetokounmpo. And then he kicks the ball out, and then they get three-pointers off that. Whereas Toronto is a more conventional offense. Home team advantage or home court advantage has been very important. This game could have been a Milwaukee runaway. Toronto won 2 at home. So now going back to Milwaukee, we'll see if they can maintain home court, as they say.
Well, you know what some people on the coast that the Warriors are on are saying is it doesn't matter who wins the East. The Warriors are so good. Do you agree?
I think this is consensus from coast to coast.
Okay.
And it does matter. But the Warriors have proved to be excellent. And the fascinating thing is they lost arguably the best player, their best player, Kevin Durant. He went down before the Portland series. He went down in game five of the Houston series. And all the Warriors have done is won without him. And actually, in games with Steph Curry, mm-hmm. when Kevin Durant is gone, they have an unbelievable record. And they play with so much more joy and they play with such crisp ball movement. So Durant should be coming back, but I don't know if NBA fans want it. I think that they could win with or without Durant, but the without Durant version of play is just aesthetically brilliant basketball. Hmm. The with Durant version is more like the unstoppable juggernaut that causes fewer smiles, but more anguish as they vanquish opponents.
Anguish, vanquish. That was good. Yeah. Real quick, we got a minute. We want to mention, of course, the NHL Stanley Cup Finals start Monday night in Boston. The Bruins hosting the St. Louis Blues. Thoughts?
These are two very good teams. Mm-hmm. I would say that the Bruins are the favorite right now. The Blues have never won since they were invented as a team in the late 60s. Vladimir Tarasenko of the Blues is a great offensive player, and they have another. His line mate, Jaden Schwartz, has two hat tricks in the playoffs so mm-hmm. far. So they are offensively skilled. I would say the Bruins' greatest advantage, if you look at the roster, is their goaltender, Tuukka Rask, who, with the two use in his last name reminds me of the word vacuum, which is what he does in his first name, which is what he does in goal. And history shows that the hot goaltender is the key to winning in the NHL.
This one has a force field around him. It's amazing. Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
This month, laws severely restricting abortion have been signed by the governors of Alabama and Georgia, prompting calls for boycotts of those states. A boycott could have real economic consequences in Georgia because of its film industry. This week, Kristen Wiig and Reed Morano pulled out of shooting projects there, and Ron Howard, David Simon, and Alyssa Milano are also calling for a Georgia boycott. Joining us now is Greg Bluestein, who's a political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Hi, Greg.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. So in 2008, Georgia offered this tax credit to try to get Hollywood productions to film in Georgia, and a lot of them did. Give us a sense of how big the industry is there and how important it is to the economy.
It is a hugely important economic driver for Georgia's economy, and it's really throughout the state. Metro Atlanta, you've seen an infrastructure of film studios, editing bays, all these different industries crop up all around the film industry, but really it goes far beyond Atlanta. And so you see small towns, you see big cities, you see areas like Savannah far from the Metro Atlanta area that have really had their own little film industries crop up as well.
And a lot of people employed by the film industry at this point in Georgia.
Yeah, about 90,000 or so, and it's growing. Georgia's even financed a state-sponsored Georgia Film Academy to train people in the behind-the-scenes work of making these productions and editing these productions. And also, you have to think about all the caterers, the props departments, all these other smaller businesses that may not necessarily cater just to the film industry, but derive a lot of their income from it.
And Georgia is now the third biggest state when it comes to film and TV production after California and New York. And unlike other states, Georgia's tax credit for this stuff is unlimited, right? There's no cap.
Yep, it's unlimited, and it has been a huge boon for these Hollywood studios who have since 2008 or so have really started pouring more and more resources into Georgia. And it's interesting thinking, you know, that this was sponsored by Republican Governor Sonny Perdue way back more than a decade ago and expanded by Nathan Deal. So even these conservative governors have been sort of catering to a very liberal Hollywood film industry. And it's been sometimes tense, but not nearly as tense as it's getting now.
Okay, so tell us about the governor there right now, Republican Governor Brian Kemp. He doesn't seem to be taking this call for a boycott so seriously. He's talking about C-list Hollywood celebrities being upset.
Yeah, it's been a change in tone from him. The film tax credit is sort of a third rail in Georgia politics. No one, even Brian Kemp, is supporting doing away with those film tax credits. He says that it's seen as an economic generator for Georgia. Always all along, he said, hey, I'm fighting for Georgia values, not Hollywood values. But over the weekend, he went a step further and mocked those who are threatening to boycott Georgia by calling them C-list celebrities and basically saying, bring it on.
So what is likely to happen then? Is he going to have to succumb to the pressure of the economics of this? If these Hollywood studios decide that they're not going to film in Georgia, the economy is going to take a hit. Is Kemp going to have to back off?
Yeah, and remember, this is a governor who is campaigning on making Georgia the number one state in the nation to do business, primarily for small businesses. And so this could be a black mark on his resume if the film industry starts to leave Georgia. Now, what the governor and his allies are hoping is that once this moves into the courts, he can just kind of, you know, say, hey, it's in the court system. It's out of our hands right now. I signed it, but now it's up to the appellate system. But what studio executives here really worry is they worry about the calls they're not getting. You know, if you're talking about where you might locate your film, you might just take Georgia off the board from the get-go, and we'll never know about those.
Well, and we should also say that Stacey Abrams, who narrowly lost to Brian Kemp in the governor's race, says that a boycott may not be the most effective choice for change either. She's not in favor of the abortion law, but she does believe that, you know, a lot of people will be harmed by a boycott in Georgia.
They call it the fight and stay movement. I mean, and this is primarily being led by Abrams and other Democrats who oppose the measure, but say, hey, packing up from Georgia and not investing in the state only hurts the tens of thousands of people who are working in the industry, many of them, by the way, who are Democrats. So they're saying that rather than do that, support causes like ACLU that are challenging this legislation.
That's Greg Bluestein, who's a political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Greg, thanks.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, as the race among Democrats to replace President Trump continues, two of the candidates, former Vice President Joe Biden and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, have a disagreement that dates back more than a decade, one that defines a major rift within the Democratic Party. Anthony Brooks from member station WBUR reports.
Warren's politics define the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, while Biden occupies the center. It's a profound difference, and it was visible when they first clashed 14 years ago.
Now, forget bankruptcy. I'm asking a larger question.
No,
forget
that's
about
what
bankruptcy.
I mean. It's the question of what role bankruptcy plays.
But that's not my question. I'd like you to answer my question.
The year was 2005. Biden was the ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Warren, a Harvard Law professor, an expert on bankruptcy. Biden, along with most Republicans, favored a bill to reform the bankruptcy laws, essentially to make it more difficult to file for bankruptcy. Warren opposed the law because she saw bankruptcy as a crucial protection for working families hit by financial devastation.
Those families have to turn somewhere, and that means now they turn as a last-ditch effort to the bankruptcy court.
Right. And that means they turn to...
As the argument went on, Warren talked about how credit card interest rates hurt working families. Biden pushed back.
Your problem with the credit card companies is usury rates from your position. It's not about the bankruptcy bill.
But, Senator, if you're not going to fix that problem, you can't take away the last shred of protection for
these
families.
I got it. Okay. You're very good, Professor.
So here are three important points about that moment. First, Biden and 17 other Democrats joined Republicans and voted in favor of the bankruptcy bill, which became law. Second, the credit card industry, much of which is based in Biden's home state of Delaware, supported the bill, even wrote some of the key amendments. And third, that moment solidified Warren's political views.
It led her to believe that the system was really broken.
This is Matthew Iglesias, a political and financial policy writer for Vox. He says that Warren-Biden clash offers a window into a fundamental disagreement within the Democratic Party today. On one side, Elizabeth Warren, a leading progressive, says the American political system is rigged against working families. On the other side is Biden.
He's talking about how Donald Trump is an aberration, and he has a sort of restorationist view that we should go back to a time when we had these kind of big bipartisan bills, when he thinks America was working better. And Warren's view is that America was actually working terribly back then.
The single most important thing we have to accomplish is defeat Donald Trump.
Biden's view is that President Trump, first and foremost, is what ails America. And that what the country needs is to return to a time when Democrats like him worked with Republicans. Here he is at a campaign rally in Philadelphia this past weekend.
I've worked across the aisle to reach consensus, to help make government work in the past. I can do that again with your help.
By contrast, Warren advocates for fundamental structural changes. Things like anti-corruption legislation and a tax on the super wealthy to make the economy fairer. She says what ails America predates Trump, and she makes it clear that her views were forged by her study of the middle class and bankruptcy, as she explained at a CNN town hall last month.
I got in that fight, and I fought it for 10 years. And by the end of that fight, I fully understood that every single Republican stood there for the banks, and half of the Democrats did.
So it's not just Trump. Warren says it's Republicans, Democrats, and Biden. In fact, on the day Biden announced his presidential campaign, Warren attacked him for that vote 14 years ago.
At a time when the biggest financial institutions in this country were trying to put the squeeze on millions of hardworking families, Joe Biden was on the side of the credit card companies.
Biden has pledged not to speak ill of fellow Democrats, but his campaign says his support of the bankruptcy bill all those years ago helped make a Republican bill fairer to middle-class families. But expect Warren to return to this argument as she battles Biden in the months ahead. And Biden knows Warren is a tough adversary.
Do you solemnly swear that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all...
Back in 2013, then-Vice President Biden swore in the newly elected Elizabeth Warren to the Senate. When the brief ceremony ended, he put his arm around her, and referring to that fight over the bankruptcy bill, he said, "You gave me hell." Warren laughed. Biden was smiling. But he probably didn't know that within just a few years, she would challenge him again, this time for the soul of the Democratic Party. For Here and Now, I'm Anthony Brooks.
Testing for ancestry DNA is very popular. Who wouldn't want to know their lineage?
Growing up, we were German. We danced in a German dance group. I wore lederhosen. When I first got on Ancestry, I was really surprised that I wasn't finding all of these Germans in my tree. I decided to have my DNA tested through Ancestry DNA. The big surprise was we're not German at all. 52% of my DNA comes from Scotland and Ireland. So I traded in my lederhosen for a kilt.
Ancestry. But did you know, as tests from companies like Ancestry and 23andMe evolve, get more data, they get smarter. And the results evolve as well, and they may change. They may later decide you're not of Scottish descent. You actually are of German descent. This caveat is explained by Damien Gardet, a reporter for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. And first, Damien, remind us, how are these tests supposed to work?
So the idea basically is that you spit into a tube and you ship it away to one of these companies and they dig into the DNA contained therein and compare it with reference populations from around the world and give you an estimate of basically what your ancestry is based on the saliva you supplied them.
But you spoke to people who, for instance, I'm looking at one, a young man who believed he was 100% Korean. His test came back and he found out what?
Well, he learned in 2016 when he took a test from 23andMe that he was almost half Japanese.
And that is, first of all, to find out that you have a different ancestry than you thought you had is kind of shocking. But in this case, that is very important culturally.
Exactly. The history between Korea and Japan is fraught. It's one that has incidents of bloodshed, of oppression, and of war. So it was a fairly serious thing for him to fathom as someone who had thought of his identity for about three decades as one thing and then learning that it was another.
So he was absorbing that and trying to slowly claim his Japanese heritage when he went back. Now, how do you go back and what did he find out?
So he was in a situation at a bar where someone expressed doubts that he was, in fact, nearly half Japanese. So he called up the 23andMe website to prove his point, only to realize that his results had been updated and he was now back to being basically fully Korean.
Now, talk about that. They update the results. Why is that?
So the way it works, basically, is that any given conclusion that one of these companies makes is only as strong as the data they have to support it. And they're upfront about this. And 23andMe and others are constantly endeavoring to expand the data that they have to draw these conclusions. And going back historically, DNA population samples have been extraordinarily white. And so if you are of especially African or, in this guy's case, East Asian descent, the conclusions that have been drawn in the past were pretty flimsy. So as they drill down, they can zero in on tighter populations. And as a result, you may learn that an earlier test conclusion was totally wrong.
I mean, as you said, they are transparent about this, both Ancestry.com, 23andMe. They're upfront about this.
Exactly. I think where the sort of existential whiplash can come in for people is that while the services themselves kind of advertise what we just described as more of a feature than a bug, the marketing, as you alluded to, makes it seem as though taking this test will provide you with a definitive idea about your identity. And, you know, when you talk to bioethicists or genealogists, they'll point out very strongly that, yes, DNA is science, but the concept of ethnicity is a cultural construct. Right. And furthermore, borders, like telling someone that their lineage is tied to a certain country, well, the borders are a political construct. So when you start to blur the lines between those things, you can invite trouble.
Right. 23andMe also does medical testing. You write that this same phenomenon of evolving DNA ancestry, this also holds true for these genetic tests that do look at health or disease risk. In other words, if you're looking to see if you have a genetic predisposition for something, you shouldn't hold that test result too close either.
That's very true. So the same principle applies that conclusions get better the more data that's behind them. And the medical conclusions can actually become intertwined with some of the ethnic and ancestry ones because there are certain diseases that particularly affect certain ethnic populations or people from certain parts of the world. And so all of this creates some eyebrow-raising issues, considering that it's a consumer product that's advertised on television, but that purports to tell people information that can have implications far beyond anything else you might buy at the checkout line in the drugstore.
Now, one other thing you note, I mean, these things are so wildly popular, and one little piece of this is that white supremacists have been flocking to these ancestry tests. But many of them are not liking what they find out because it shows that they have things in their genetic background that they'd fall on a sword because of it. And that may not even be true. Do you think people will stop using these tests as much?
I don't. I think that there is an allure to decoding a mystery to oneself. Like maybe arguably kind of a narcissistic tendency that we all have to want to confirm some suspicion we've had about ourselves, and maybe we're a little more interesting than people assume, or maybe we want to confirm a long rumored tie to some sort of royal ancestry that a grandparent once claimed. I think that this is probably only going to expand, and I think the lesson for people who might be customers of this is to make sure that you are conscious of the grains of salt with which you should accept anything you're told.
Damien Gardet is a reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Damien, thank you.
Thank you.
So, spitter beware if you're going to take one of these tests. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.